Belinda presents this unabridged recording of Gamble, a Dick Francis novel, written by Felix Francis and read by Michael Maloney.
Chapter 1. I was standing right next to Herb Kovac when he was murdered. Executed would have been a better word. Shot 3 times from close range, 2 in the heart and 1 in the face, he was almost certainly dead before he hit the ground, and definitely before the gunman had turned away and disappeared into the Grand National Race Day crowd. The shooting had happened so fast that neither Herb nor I, nor anyone else for that matter, would have had a chance to prevent it. In fact, I hadn't realized what was actually going on until it was over, and Herb was already dead at my feet. I wondered if Herb himself had had the time to comprehend that his life was in danger before the bullets tore into his body to end it. Probably not, and I found that strangely comforting. I had liked Herb, but someone else clearly hadn't. The murder of Herb Kovac changed everyone's day, not just his. The police took over the situation with their usual insensitive efficiency, cancelling one of the world's major sporting events with just 30 minutes' notice and requiring the more than 60,000 frustrated spectators to wait patiently in line for several hours to give their names and addresses.
But you must have seen his face.
I was sitting at a table opposite an exasperated police detective inspector in one of the restaurants that had been cleared of its usual clientele and set up as an emergency incident room.
I've already told you, I said. I wasn't looking at the man's face.
I thought back once again to those few fatal seconds, and all I could remember clearly was the gun.
So it was a man?
The inspector asked.
I think so, I said. Was he black or white?
The gun was black, I said. With a silencer.
It didn't sound very helpful, even I could tell that.
Mr. The
detective consulted the notebook on the table. Foxton.
Is there nothing else you can tell us about the murderer?
I'm sorry, I said, shaking my head. It all happened so quickly. He changed his line of questioning.
So how well did you know Mr. Kovac?
Well enough, I said. We work together. Have done for the past 5 years or so. I'd say we're work friends.
I paused.
At least, we were.
It was difficult to believe that he was dead.
What line of work?
Financial services, I said. We're independent financial advisors.
I could almost see the detective's eyes glaze over with boredom.
It may not be as exciting as riding in the Grand National, I said, but it's not that bad.
He looked up at my face.
And have you ridden in the Grand National?
His voice was full of sarcasm, and he was smiling.
As a matter of fact, I have, I said.
2. The smile faded. Oh, he said. Oh, indeed, I thought.
And I won it the 2nd time.
It was unlike me to talk much about what I now felt was a previous life, and bragging about it was even more uncharacteristic. I silently rebuked myself for my indulgence, but I was getting a little irritated by the policeman's attitude, not only towards me, but also towards my dead colleague. He looked down again at his notes.
Foxton, he said, reading.
He looked up.
Not Foxy Foxton.
Yes, I said. Although I'd long been trying to give up the Foxy nickname, preferring my real name of Nicholas, which I felt was more suited to a serious life in the city.
Well, well, said the policeman, I want a few quid on you.
I smiled. He'd probably lost a few quid too, but I wasn't going to say so.
Not riding today, then?
No, I said, not for a long time. Had it really been 8 years, I thought, since I had last ridden in a race? In some ways it felt like only yesterday, but in others it was a lifetime away. The policeman wrote another line in his notebook.
So now you're a financial advisor?
Yes.
Bit of a come down, wouldn't you say?
I thought about replying that it was better than being a policeman, but decided, in the end, that silence was probably the best policy. Anyway, I tended to agree with him. My whole life had been a bit of a come-down since those heady days of hurling myself over Aintree fences with half a ton of horseflesh between my legs. "Who do you advise?" he asked. "Anyone who'll pay me," I said, rather flippantly.
"And Mr. Kovac?"
"Him too," I said. "We both work for a firm of independent financial advisers in the city."
"Here in Liverpool?"
he asked. "No," I said. "The City of London."
"Which firm?"
"Lyle and Black," I said. "Our offices are in Lombard Street." He wrote it down.
"Can you think of any reason why anyone would want Mr. Kovac dead?"
It was the question I'd been asking myself over and over again for the past 2 hours. "No," I said, "absolutely not. Everyone liked Herb. He was always smiling and happy. He was the life and soul of any party."
"How long did you say you've known him?" asked the detective.
5 years. We joined the firm at the same time."
"I understand he was an American citizen."
"Yes," I said. "He came from Louisville in Kentucky. He used to go back to the States a couple of times a year." Everything was written down in the inspector's notebook.
"Was he married?"
"No."
"Girlfriend?"
"None that I knew of," I said.
"Were you and he in a gay relationship?"
the policeman asked in a deadpan tone of voice, his eyes still on his notes.
"No," I said, equally deadpan. "I'll find out, you know," he said, looking up.
"There's nothing to find out," I said. "I may have worked with Mr. Kovac, but I live with my girlfriend."
"Where?"
"Finchley," I said. "North London." I gave him my full address and he wrote it down.
"Was Mr. Kovac involved in a gay relationship with anyone else?"
"What makes you think he was gay?" I asked.
"No wife, no girlfriend. What else should I think?"
"I have no reason to believe Herb was gay. In fact, I know he wasn't."
"How do you know?"
The policeman leaned towards me purposefully. I thought back to those rare occasions when Herb and I had spent any time together, sometimes in hotels where we would be staying overnight at financial conferences. He had never made any sort of pass at me, and he had occasionally chatted up the local girls and then boasted about his conquests over breakfast. It was true that I'd never actually seen him in a sexual situation with a woman, but I hadn't seen him with a man either.
"I just know," I said weakly.
Said the inspector, clearly not believing me, and making another note in his book. But did I really know? And did it matter?
"What difference would it make anyway?" I asked. "Lots of murders have a sexual motive," said the detective. "Until we know differently, we have to explore every avenue."
It was nearly dark before I was finally allowed to leave the racecourse, and it had also started raining. The courtesy shuttle service to the distant park-and-ride car park had long since ceased running, and I was cold, wet, and thoroughly fed up by the time I reached my Mercedes. But I sat for some while in the car before setting off, once more going over and over in my mind the events of the day. I had picked Herb up from his flat at Seymour Way in Hendon soon after 8 in the morning, and we had set off to Liverpool in great good humour. It was to be Herb's first trip to the Grand National, and he was uncharacteristically excited by the prospect. He had grown up in the shadow of the iconic twin spires of Churchill Downs Racetrack, the venue of the Kentucky Derby, and spiritual home of American thoroughbred racing, but he had always claimed that gambling on the horses had ruined his childhood. I'd asked him to come to the races with me quite a few times before, but he had always declined, claiming that the memories were still too painful. However, there'd been no sign of that today, as I had driven north on the motorway, the two of us chatting amicably about our work, our lives, and our hopes and fears for the future. Little did we know then how short Herb's future was going to be. He and I had always got on fairly well over the past 5 years, but mostly on a strictly colleague-to-colleague level. Today had been the first day of a promising, deeper friendship. It had also been the last. I sat alone in my car and grieved for my newfound but so quickly lost friend. But still, I had no idea why anyone would want him dead. My journey back to Finchley seemed to be never-ending. There was an accident on the M6 north of Birmingham with a 5-mile tailback. It said so on the radio, sandwiched between endless news bulletins about the murder of Herb and the cancellation of the Grand National. Not that they mentioned Herb by name, of course. He was just referred to as a man. I assumed the police would withhold his identity until his next of kin had been informed. But who, I wondered, were his next of kin? And how would the authorities find them? Thankfully, I thought, that wasn't my problem. I came upon the back of the traffic congestion just south of Stoke, the mass of red brake lights ahead of me shining brightly in the darkness. I have to admit that I am usually an impatient driver. I suppose it is a case of once a racer, always a racer. It makes little difference to me if my steed has four legs or four wheels. If I see a gap, I tend to take it. It was the way I had ridden during my all-too-short 4 years as a jockey, and it had served me well. But that evening, I didn't have the energy to get irritated by the queues of near-stationary cars. Instead, I sat quietly in the outside lane as we crawled past an upturned motorhome that had spread its load of human and domestic clutter across half the carriageway. One shouldn't look at others' misfortune, but of course we all did, and thanked our lucky stars it wasn't us lying there on the cold tarmac receiving medical assistance. I stopped at one of the motorway service areas and called home. Claudia, my girlfriend, answered at the second ring. "Hello, it's me," I said. "I'm on my way home, but I'll be a couple of hours more at least." "Good day?" she asked. "Have you seen the news?" "No, why?" I knew she wouldn't have. Claudia was an artist, and she had planned to spend the day painting in what she called her studio, but what was actually the guest bedroom of the house we shared. Once she closed the door, turned up the music on her iPod headphones, and set to work on a canvas, it would take an earthquake or a nuclear strike to penetrate her bubble. I'd been quite surprised that she'd answered the phone. "The National was cancelled," I said.
"Cancelled?"
"Well, there's talk of them holding the race on Monday, but it was cancelled for today."
"Why?" she asked.
"Someone was murdered."
"How inconvenient of them."
There was laughter in her voice. "It was Herb," I said.
"What was Herb?"
she asked. The laughter had gone. "It was Herb who was murdered."
"Oh, my God!" she screamed. "How?"
"Watch the news."
"But Nick," she said, concerned. "I mean, are you okay?"
"I'm fine. I'll be home as soon as I can." Next, I tried to call my boss, Herb's boss, to warn him of the coming disruption to business, as I was sure there would be, but there was no answer. I decided against leaving a message. Somehow, voicemail didn't seem the right medium for bad news. I set off southwards again and spent the remainder of the journey as I had the first part, thinking about Herb and wondering why anyone should want to kill him. But there were so many questions and so few answers. How did the murderer know Herb would be at Aintree today? Had we been followed from London and stalked around the racecourse? Had Herb really been the target, or had it been a case of mistaken identity? And why would anyone commit murder with 60,000 potential witnesses in close attendance when surely it would be safer to lure their victim alone into some dark, quiet alley? I'd said as much to the detective inspector, but he hadn't thought it particularly unusual.
"Sometimes it's easier for an assailant to get away if there is a big crowd to hide in," he'd said. "Also, it can pamper to their ego to do it in a public place with witnesses."
"But it must make it more likely that he would be recognized, or at least allow you to get a good description."
"You'd be surprised," he said. "More witnesses often mean more confusion. They all see things differently, and we end up with a description of a black-white man with straight curly hair, forearms and two heads. And everyone tends to look at the bleeding victim rather than the perpetrator of the crime. We often get a great description of the corpse, but nothing about the murderer."
"But how about CCTV?" I'd asked him.
"It appears that the particular spot behind the grandstand where Mr. Kovac was shot is not in view of any of the racecourse security cameras, and was also not visible from any of the cameras brought in by the television people to cover the event."
The assassin had known what he was doing in that respect. It had clearly been a professional hit. But why? Every line of thought came back to the same question. Why would anyone want to kill Herb Kovac? I knew that some of our clients could get pretty cross when an investment that had been recommended to them went down in value rather than up. But to the point of murder? Surely not.
People like Herb and me didn't live in a world of contract killers and hitmen. We simply existed in an environment of figures and computers, profits and returns, interest rates and guilt yields, not of guns and bullets and violent death. The more I thought about it, the more convinced I became that, professional as the hit may have been, the killer must have shot the wrong man.
I was hungry and weary by the time I pulled the Mercedes into the parking area in front of my house in Litchfield Grove, Finchley. It was 10 minutes to midnight, and just 16 hours since I had left here this morning. It felt longer, about a week longer. Claudia had waited up and she came out to the car.
I watched the television news, she said. I can't believe it.
Neither could I. It all seemed so unreal.
I was standing right next to him, I said. One moment he was alive and laughing about which horse we should bet on, and the next second he was dead.
Awful, she stroked my arm.
Do they know who did it?
Not that they told me, I said.
What did it say on the news?
Not much, really, Claudia said. Just a couple of so-called experts disagreeing with each other about whether it was as a result of terrorism or organized crime.
It was an assassination, I said firmly, plain and simple.
But who on earth would want to assassinate Herb Kovac? Claudia said. I only met him twice, but he seemed such a gentle soul.
I agree, I said, and the more I think about it, the more certain I become that it must have been a case of mistaken identity. Perhaps that's also why the police haven't yet revealed who was shot. They don't want to let the killer know he hit the wrong man.
I walked round to the back of the car and opened the boot. It had been a warm and sunny spring day when we'd arrived at Aintree, and we had decided to leave our overcoats in the car. I looked down at them both lying there, Herb's dark blue one on top of my own brown.
Oh, God, I said out loud, suddenly becoming quite emotional again. What shall I do with that?
Leave it there, said Claudia, slamming the boot shut. She took me by the arm. Come on, Nick. Time to put you to bed.
I'd rather have a stiff drink or two.
Okay, she said with a smile. A couple of stiff drinks first, then bed.
I didn't feel much better in the morning, but that might have had something to do with the few more than a couple of stiff drinks I'd consumed before finally going to bed around 2 o'clock. I'd never been much of a drinker, not least as a need to keep my riding weight down when I'd been a jockey. I had left school with 3 top grades at A-level, and much to the dismay of my parents and teachers, I had forgone the offered place at the LSE, the London School of Economics, for a life in the saddle. So aged 18, when many young men going up to university were learning how to use their new-found freedom to pour large amounts of alcohol down their throats, I'd been pounding the streets of Lambourne in a sweatsuit or sitting alone in a sauna trying to shed an extra pound or two. However, the previous evening, the shock of the day's events had begun to show. So I had dug out the half bottle of single malt whiskey left over from Christmas and polished it off before climbing the stairs to bed. But of course the spirit didn't take away the demons in my head, and I had spent much of the night troubled and awake, unable to remove the mental image of Herb growing cold on a marble slab in some Liverpool mortuary. The weather on Sunday morning was as miserable as I was, with a string of heavy April showers blowing in on a bracing northerly breeze. At about 10, during a break in the rain, I went out for a Sunday paper, nipping up to the newsagent on Regent's Park Road.
A very good morning to you, Mr. Foxton, said the shop owner from behind the counter.
Morning, Mr. Patel, I said in reply, but I'm not sure what's good about it. Mr. Patel smiled at me and said nothing. We may have lived in the same place, but we did so with different cultures. All the front pages on the shelves had the same story. Death at the races, read one headline. Murder at the National, read another. Gun horror at Aintree, ran a third. I glanced quickly at them all. None gave the name of the victim, and to me there appeared to be far greater coverage about the aggravation and inconvenience suffered by the crowd, rather than any commiseration or condolence towards poor Herb. I suppose some conjecture was to be expected, as the reporters had so little real factual information from which to make a story, but I was surprised at their apparent lack of sympathy for the target of the assassin. One paper even went so far as to suggest that the murder was likely to have been drug-related, and then went on to imply that everyone else was probably better off with the victim dead. I bought a copy of the Sunday Times for no better reason than its headline, Police Hunt Race Day Assassin. was the least sensational, and the story beneath it didn't immediately assume that Herb had probably deserved to be killed.
"Thank you, sir,"
said Mr. Patel, giving me my change. I tucked the heavy newspaper under my arm and retraced my tracks home. Lichfield Grove was a fairly typical London suburban street of mostly 1930s-built semi-detached houses with bay windows and small front gardens. I had lived here now for the past 8 years, yet I hardly knew my neighbours other than to wave at, occasionally, if we happened to arrive or leave our homes at the same time. In fact, I knew Mr. Patel, the newsagent, better than those I lived right next to. I was aware that the couple on one side were called Jane and Phil, or was it John? But I had no idea of their surname, or what either of them did for a living. As I walked back from the newsagent, I thought how strange it was that members of the human race could live here so cheek by jowl with their fellow beings without any meaningful reaction between them. But at least it made a change from the rural village life I had experienced before, where everyone took pains to know every other person's business, and where nothing could be kept a secret for long. I wondered whether I should make more of an effort to be more community-minded. I suppose it would depend on how long I intended to stay. Many of my racing friends had thought that Finchley was a strange choice, but I had needed a clean break from my former life. A clean break. That was a joke. It had been a clean break that had forced me to stop race riding just as I was beginning to make my mark in the sport. The clean break in question was to my second cervical vertebra, the axis, on which the atlas vertebra above it rotated to turn the head. In short, I had broken my neck. I suppose I should be thankful that the break hadn't killed or paralysed me, either of which could have been a highly likely outcome. The fact that I was now walking down Lichfield Grove at all was due to the prompt and gentle care of the paramedics on duty at Cheltenham Racecourse that fateful day. They had taken great pains to immobilise my neck and spine before I was lifted from the turf. It had been a silly fall, and I had to admit to a degree of carelessness on my part. The last race on the Wednesday of the Cheltenham Steeplechase Festival is what is known as the Bumper, a National Hunt flat race, no jumps, no hurdles, just 2 miles of undulating rich green grass between start and finish. It is not the greatest spectacle the festival has to offer, and many of the large crowd had already made their way to the car parks, or the bar. But the Bumper is very competitive, and the jockeys take it very seriously. Not often do the jump boys and girls get to emulate Willie Shoemaker or Frankie Dettori. Judging the pace with no jumps to break up the rhythm is an art, and knowing where and when to make your final challenge to the finish can make all the difference to the outcome. That particular Wednesday, just over 8 years ago, I had been riding a horse that the Racing Post had rather kindly called an outsider. The horse had just one speed, moderate, and absolutely no turn of foot to take it past others up the final climb to victory. My only chance was to go off fairly fast from the start and try to run the finish out of the others. The plan worked quite well, up to a point. At about halfway, my mount and I were some 15 lengths in front of the nearest challenger and still going reasonably well as we swung left-handed and down the hill. But the sound of the pursuers was getting ever louder in my ears, and 6 or 7 of them swept past us like Ferraris overtaking a steamroller as we turned into the straight. The race was lost, and it was no great surprise to me, or to the few still watching from the grandstands. Perhaps the horse beneath sensed a subtle change in me, a change from expectation and excitement to resignation and disappointment. Or perhaps the horse was no longer concentrating on the task in hand in the same way that his jockey's mind was wandering to the following day's races and his rides to come. Whatever the real cause, one moment he was galloping along serenely, albeit one-paced, and the next he had stumbled and gone down as if shot. I had seen the television replay. I'd had no chance. The fall had catapulted me over the horse's neck and head first into the ground. I had woken up 2 days later in the neurosurgery and spinal injuries department of French A Hospital in Bristol with a humdinger of a headache and a metal contraption called a halo brace surrounding and literally screwed into my skull. 3 uncomfortable months later, with the metal halo finally removed, I set about regaining my fitness and place in the saddle, only for my hopes to be dashed by the horse racing authority's medical board, who decided that I was
permanently unfit to return to racing. "Too risky," they had said. "Another fall on your head could prove fatal." I had argued that I was prepared to accept the risk and pointed out that a fall on the head could prove fatal even if you hadn't previously broken your neck. I had tried at length to explain to them that all jockeys risked their lives every time they climbed aboard half a ton of horse and galloped at 30 miles per hour over 5-foot fences. Jockeys were well used to taking risks and accepted the consequences without blaming the authorities. But it was all to no avail. "Sorry," they said. "Our decision is final." So that had been that. From being the new kid on the block, the youngest winning jockey of the Grand National since Bruce Hobbs in 1938, and widely tipped to be the next champion, I was suddenly a 21-year-old ex-jockey with nothing to fall back on.
"You will need an education for when your riding days are over," my father had once said in a last futile attempt to make me take up my place at university instead of going racing when I was 18.
"Then I'll get my education when I need it," I'd replied. And so I had, applying again and being accepted once more by the LSE to read for a combined degree in government and economics. And hence I had come to live in Finchley, putting down a deposit on the house from the earnings of my last successful season in the saddle. Finchley Central Underground Station, round the corner from Lichfield Grove, was just 10 stops up the northern line from the LSE. But it hadn't been an easy change. I had become used to the adrenaline-fueled excitement of riding horses at speed over obstacles when winning was the thing. Winning, winning, winning. Nothing else mattered. Everything I did was with winning in mind. I loved it. I lived it. It was like a drug, and I was addicted. When it was snatched away from me, I suffered badly from withdrawal symptoms. An alcoholic with the DTs had nothing on me. In those first few months, I tried hard to put on a brave face, busying myself with buying the house and getting ready for my studies, cursing my luck and telling everyone that I was fine. But inside I was sick, shaking, and near suicidal. Another shower was about to fall out of the darkening sky as I hurried the last few yards along the road to my house with the newspaper. In keeping with many of my neighbours, I had arranged early on to concrete over my small overgrown front lawn, converting it into an off-road parking space that was now occupied by my ageing Mercedes SLK sports car. I had excitedly bought the car brand new with my percentage from the Grand National win. That had been 10 years and more than 180,000 miles ago, and in truth, I was well past needing a change. I opened the boot and looked down at the two coats lying there. The previous evening, the sight of Herb's blue cashmere had almost been too much for me to bear, but now it appeared as just an overcoat without a home. I picked them both up, slammed the boot shut, and hurried inside as the first large drops of rain began to wet my hair. I hung my coat on one of the hooks behind the front door and wondered what I should do with Herb's. He wouldn't be needing it now, but I suppose it belonged to his family and would go back to them eventually. In the meantime, I hung it up next to mine in my hallway. I am not quite sure why I went through the pockets. Maybe I thought that he might have left his flat key there as he'd been wearing the coat when he'd locked his door the previous morning. There was no key, but there was a piece of paper deep in the left-hand pocket. It had been roughly folded over and screwed up. I flattened it out on the wall. I stood there in disbelief, reading the stark message written on the paper in black ballpoint. "You should have done what you were told. You may say you regret it, but you won't be regretting it for long." Did that mean Herb had been the real target? Had the assassin actually shot the right man? And if so, why? Chapter 2. I spent much of Sunday morning reading and rereading the message on the paper, trying to work out whether it actually was a prediction of murder, or just an innocent communication with no relevance to the events at the Grand National the previous afternoon. "You should have done what you were told. You may say you regret it, but you won't be regretting it for long."
I dug out the business card that I'd been given at Aintree by the detective, Inspector Paul Matthews, Merseyside Police. I tried the number printed there, but he wasn't available. I left a message asking him to call me back. I wondered what it was that Herb should have done, what he'd been told to do, and for what, and to whom had he expressed regret. I gave up trying to work it out and read the many reports about the murder in the Sunday Times. I thought again about calling my boss, but he would also read about it in the papers, and he would find out soon enough that the victim had been his senior assistant. Why spoil his Sunday lunch? I knew all too well from my time as a jockey that one should never believe what one reads in newspapers, but on this occasion, I was surprised how accurate they were as far as the factual information was concerned. The Sunday Times correspondents clearly had good links direct to Merseyside Police Headquarters, but not so good that they could actually name the victim. And they had little or no information about any motive, but that didn't stop them from speculating. Such a clinical assassination has all the hallmarks of a gangland organised crime hit. It went on to suggest that a reason the name of the victim was being withheld was possibly because he was a well-known criminal and the police didn't want potential witnesses to feel it wasn't worth coming forward. Oh, that's rubbish, I said out loud. What's rubbish? Claudia asked. I was sitting in our small kitchen with a newspaper spread out across the kitchen table while Claudia was baking a cake for her sister's birthday, her long black hair tied back in a ponytail. This in the paper, I said. They're suggesting that Herb was a criminal and probably deserved to be killed. And was he? Claudia asked, turning round. Of course not, I said firmly. How do you know? She asked, echoing the detective inspector. I just do, I said. I worked at the next desk to him for the past 5 years. Don't you think I'd have noticed if he was a criminal? Not necessarily, Claudia said. Do you think those who worked next to Bernie Madoff realised he was a crook? And how about that doctor, Harold Shipman? He murdered 200 of his patients over more than 20 years before anyone suspected him. She was right. She usually was. I had met Claudia during my second year at the LSE. We actually met on the London Underground, the Tube, an environment not usually renowned for introducing strangers. That particular evening, nearly 6 years ago, I had been going into college for an evening event and I was sitting next to Claudia when the train came to a halt in the tunnel. 20 minutes later, the driver came through the train explaining that there was a signal problem at Euston due to an electrical fire. Another 20 minutes after that, we moved slowly forward to Kentish Town, where everybody was required to leave the train. I never did get to the evening event at the LSE. Claudia and I went to a pub for supper instead. But it was not a romantic liaison, it was strictly business. I was finding life as a student far more expensive than I'd budgeted for, and Claudia was in need of digs close to the Byamshaw School of Art, where she was studying. By the end of the evening, we had a deal. She would move into the guest bedroom in my house as a lodger and pay a contribution towards the mortgage. By the end of the same month, she had moved out of her guest bed and into mine as full-time girlfriend, while she still went on renting the guest bedroom as her studio. The arrangement still existed, although, since our student days, the rent she paid had decreased steadily to nothing as my earnings had risen and hers had remained stubbornly static at zero. Making your mark as an artist is not about commercial sales, she would wail whenever I teased her about it. It's all to do with creativity. And creative she was, there was no doubt about that. Sometimes I just wished that others would appreciate her creations enough to write out a check. As it was, the third bedroom of the house had so many finished canvases stacked against the walls there was no longer space for a bed. One day, she would say, these will all sell for tens of thousands and I'll be rich. But the main problem was that she didn't actually want to part with any of them, so she didn't even try to sell them. It was as if she painted them solely for her own benefit. And they were definitely an acquired taste, one I would call dark and foreboding, full of surreal, disturbing images of pain and distress. With the exception of a small life study in pencil drawn during her Byamshaw days, none of her work was hung on our walls, and that was because I found them impossible to live with. And yet, surprisingly, I was able to live happily with the artist. For a long while, I had worried about her state of mind, but it was as if Claudia placed all her dark thoughts into her paintings, and there they stayed, leaving her to exist outside her work in a world of brightness and colour. She herself had no real explanation for why she painted as she did, and denied that it was due to the sudden death of her parents when she'd been a child. She said it was just how things turned out when her brushes stroked the canvas. I had often thought of taking a selection of her weirdest paintings to be seen by an analyst to see if there might be some sort of psychological disturbance present. But I hadn't liked to do so without her consent, and I'd been too apprehensive to ask in case she had objected. So I had done nothing. I'd always tried to avoid personal confrontation, not least because I'd grown up with it all around me from my parents, who had fought each other tooth and nail for more than 30 years, until they had finally divorced in their late 50s. "But it says here," I said to Claudia, pointing at the newspaper, "that the murder had all the characteristics of a gangland killing. Now, surely I would have known if Herb had been involved in that sort of thing." "I bet my friends have all sorts of skeletons in their cupboards we'll never hear about." "You're such a cynic," I said. But she did have some strange friends. "A realist," she replied. "It saves being disappointed." "Disappointed?" "Yes," she said. "If I believe the worst of people, then I'm not disappointed when it turns out to be accurate." "And you believe the worst of me?" "Don't be silly," she said, coming over and stroking my hair with flower-covered hands. "I know the worst of you. And are you disappointed?" "Always," she laughed. But I began to wonder if it was true. I arrived at the offices of Lyle and Black on the fourth floor of 64 Lombard Street at 8:15 a.m. on Monday morning, to find the door blocked by a burly-looking police constable in full uniform, complete with anti-stab vest and helmet.
"Sorry, sir,"
he said in an official tone as I tried to push past him.
"No one is allowed into these offices without permission from my superior officer."
"But I work here," I said.
"Your name, sir?"
he asked. "Nicholas Foxton." He consulted a list that he had removed from his trouser pocket.
"Mr. N. Foxton," he read. "Very well, sir, you may go in."
He moved slightly to one side while I passed, but then he stepped quickly back into his former spot as if expecting to prevent a rush from those not on his list. The offices of Lyle and Black had never seen such activity so early on a Monday morning. Both the senior partners, Patrick Lyle and Gregory Black, were in the client waiting area leaning on the chest-high reception desk.
"Oh, hi, Nicholas," said Patrick as I entered. "The police are here."
"So I see," I said. "Is it to do with Herb?" They nodded.
"We've both been here since 7, Patrick said. "But they won't let us go along into our offices. We've been told not to go beyond here."
"Have they said what they're looking for exactly?" I asked.
"No,"
Gregory said sharply and with irritation. "I presume they're hoping to find some clue as to who killed him, but I'm not happy about it. There may be sensitive client material on his desk that I wouldn't want them to see. It's highly confidential." I thought it was unlikely that the police would accept that anything was in the least bit confidential if it could have a bearing on unmasking a murderer. "When did you find out he was dead?" I asked them. I knew that Herb's name had finally been included in the late news on Sunday evening.
"Yesterday afternoon," said Patrick. "I received a call from the police asking us to meet them here this morning. How about you?"
"I did try and call you on Saturday, but there was no reply," I said. "I was actually with Herb when he was shot."
"My God," said Patrick. "That's right. You were going to the races together."
"And I was standing right next to him when he was killed," I said.
"How awful," Patrick said. "Did you see who killed him?"
"Well, sort of," I said, "but I was looking mostly at his gun."
"I just don't understand it," Patrick shook his head. "Why would anyone want to kill Herb Kovac?"
"Dreadful business," said Gregory, also shaking his head. "Not good for the firm. Not good at all."
It wasn't too hot for Herb either, I thought, but decided not to say so. Lyle and Black, although very small, had risen to be one of the significant players in the financial services industry solely due to the single-mindedness of both Patrick Lyle and Gregory Black. Where Lyle and Black led, others usually followed. They took an innovative approach to their clients' investments, often recommending opportunities that more traditional advisors might classify as too risky. All independent financial advisors are required to determine and grade their clients' attitude to risk. Low-risk investments, such as fixed-interest bank accounts or AAA-rated government bonds, tended to give only a small rate of return, but the capital sum was safe.
Medium risk might include stocks in major companies or unit trusts and mutual funds, where the return should be greater, but there was a chance of losing some of the capital due to a drop in the stock market price. High-risk investments, including venture capital trusts and foreign currency dealings, gave the opportunity to make big returns, but could also result in large losses. Lyle and Black, however, also advised on investments for which the risk level could only be described as extreme, such as the financing of films or plays, buying shares in wine funds, in foreign property portfolios, or in works of art. Returns could be vast, but so were the chances of losing everything. It was the attitude that had first attracted me to them. Kicking a horse hard in the belly to ask it to lengthen its stride, to make it right for a jump, was also an extreme risk strategy that could so easily result in a crashing fall. An alternative, safer approach might be to take a pull, to ask the animal to shorten and to put in an extra stride. It may have been safer, but it was slower, much slower. A great deal better in my mind to crash to the turf trying to win than to be satisfied with second place.
"How much longer are they going to keep us waiting here?" Gregory Black demanded.
"Don't they realize we have work to do?"
No one answered. One by one, all the other staff had turned up and the client waiting area was now full to overflowing. For the most part, they had only heard of Herb's demise as they had arrived, and the last thing they wanted to do was to start work. The two ladies who doubled as receptionists and admin assistants were both in tears. Herb had been popular and much loved, and not least because he'd been a change from the usual rather straight-laced, pinstripe-suited city financier. Herb had loved being the American abroad, turning up on the 4th of July with gifts of candy sticks and apple pie, hosting an office Thanksgiving lunch of turkey and all the trimmings in November, and drawling "yee-haw" at the top of his voice like a cowboy when he'd managed to lasso a new client. Herb had been fun, and life in the office was going to be a lot less cheerful for his passing. Finally, around 9:30, a middle-aged man in an ill-fitting grey suit came into the reception and addressed the waiting faces.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he began formally, "I am Detective Chief Inspector Tomlinson of the Merseyside Police. Sorry for the inconvenience, but as you will be aware, my colleagues and I are investigating the murder of Herbert Kovac at Aintree Races on Saturday afternoon. I expect we will be here for some time, and I ask for your patience. However, I must ask you to remain here, as I will want to speak to each of you individually."
Gregory Black didn't look pleased.
"Can't we work in our offices while we wait?"
"I'm afraid that won't be possible," replied the policeman.
"And why not?" demanded Gregory.
"Because I do not want any of you," he looked around the room, "having access to your computers."
"But that's outrageous!" Gregory was building up a head of steam. "Are you accusing one of us of having something to do with Mr. Kovac's death?"
"I'm not accusing anyone," Chief Inspector Tomlinson replied in a more conciliatory tone. "I just need to cover every avenue. If evidence does exist on Mr. Kovac's computer, then I am sure you will all understand that it has to be free from any possible contamination due to any of you accessing the files through the company server."
Gregory was hardly placated.
"But all our files are remotely saved and can be viewed directly as they were at any time. This is completely ridiculous."
"Mr. Black,"
the policeman turned to face him directly,
"you are wasting my time, and the sooner I get back to work, the sooner you will be able to get into your office."
I looked at Gregory Black. I suspected that no one had spoken to him like that since he was at school, if then. There was an absolute silence in the room as we all waited for the explosion, but it didn't come. He just muttered something under his breath and turned away. But in one respect, Gregory was absolutely right. The restriction on using our computers was ridiculous. Our system allowed for remote access, so that certain members of the firm could access the company files from their laptops when away from the office. If any of us had wanted to contaminate the files since Herb's death, we'd had most of the weekend to have done so.
"Can we go out for a coffee?" asked Jessica Winter, the firm's compliance officer.
The photocopy room, which also doubled as the small kitchen where we made all our hot drinks, was beyond the offices, and hence currently out of bounds.
Yes, said the chief inspector, but not all of you at once. I will be starting the interview soon, and if you do go, please be back by 10 o'clock.
Jessica stood up quickly and made for the door. Half a dozen more made a move in the same direction, including me. Clearly, none of us exactly relished the prospect of being confined in close proximity to Gregory Black for the next half hour. I had to wait until after 11 before I was interviewed, and much to Gregory Black's annoyance, I was second on the policeman's list after Patrick Lyle. I don't know whether the policeman did it on purpose to further antagonize Gregory, but the interviews were carried out in his office and across his desk, with Chief Inspector Tomlinson sitting in the high-backed leather executive chair in which Gregory usually rested his ample frame. That wouldn't go down well, I thought, especially during a certain Gregory Black's interview.
Now then, Mr. Foxton, said the Chief Inspector while studying his papers, understand you were at Aintree Races on Saturday afternoon and were interviewed there by one of my colleagues.
Yes, I replied, by Detective Inspector Matthews.
He nodded.
Have you anything further you wish to add to what you said in that interview?
Yes, I have, I said. I tried to call Inspector Matthews yesterday. In fact, I left a message for him to call me back, but he didn't. It was about this.
I removed from my pocket the folded piece of paper I had found in Herb's coat and spread it out on the desk, rotating it so the Chief Inspector could read the words. I knew them now by heart. You should have done what you were told. You may say you regret it, but you won't be regretting it for long. After quite a few moments, he looked up at me.
Where did you find this?
In Mr. Kovac's coat pocket. He'd left his coat in my car when we arrived at the races. I found it only yesterday. The Chief Inspector studied the paper once more, but without touching it.
Do you recognize the handwriting? He asked.
No, I replied. But I wouldn't. The note had been written carefully in capital letters, each one very precise and separate.
And you have handled this paper?
I assumed it was a rhetorical question, as he had clearly seen me remove the paper from my pocket and spread it out. I remained silent.
Did you not think this might be evidence? He asked. Handling it may jeopardize the chances of recovering any forensics.
It was screwed up in his coat pocket, I said in my defense. I didn't know what it was until I'd opened it up, and by then it was too late. He studied it once more.
And what do you think it means?
I have no idea, I said, but I think it might be a warning.
A warning? Why a warning?
I've spent much of the night thinking about it, I said. It's clearly not a threat, or it would say, do as you're told or else, and not, you should have done what you were told.
Okay,
the policeman said slowly. But that doesn't make it a warning.
I know, I said, but think about it. If you wanted to kill someone, you'd hardly ring them up and tell them now, would you?
It would do nothing except put them on their guard and make it more difficult for you. They might even ask for police protection. There is absolutely nothing to be gained and everything to lose. Surely you would just do it, unannounced.
You really have thought about it, he said.
Yes, I said, a lot. And I was there when Herb was killed. There was no, you should have done so-and-so from the killer before he fired. Quite the reverse. He shot so quickly, and without preamble, that I reckon Herb was dead before he even knew what was happening. And that is not in keeping with this note. I paused. So I think this might have been a warning from someone else, not from the killer. In fact, I believe that it's almost more than a warning. It's an apology. The Chief Inspector looked up at me for a few seconds. Mr. Foxton, he said finally. This isn't a television drama, you know. In real life, people don't apologize for murdering someone before the event. So you're saying I'm wrong?
No, he said slowly. I'm not saying that. But I'm not saying you're right either. I'll keep an open mind on the matter.
It sounded to me very much like he thought I was wrong. He stood up and went to the door, and presently another officer came in and removed the piece of paper, placing it carefully into a plastic bag with some tweezers.
Now, said the Chief Inspector as the door closed. Do you know of anything in Mr. Kovac's work that might help me understand why he was killed?
Absolutely not, I said.
Mr. Lyle told me that you and Mr. Kovac worked closely together.
I nodded.
So what did he do exactly?
The same as me, I said. He worked mostly for Patrick Lyle as one of his assistants, but he also had some clients of his own.
Sorry, said the Chief Inspector, interrupting. I'm a little confused. Mr. Lyle didn't mention that Mr. Kovac was his personal assistant.
But he wasn't like a secretary or anything, I said. He assisted in the monitoring of the investments of Mr. Lyle's clients. He said, pausing and not appearing to be any the wiser. Could you describe to me exactly what you do here, and also what this firm does?
Okay, I said. I'll try. I took a breath and thought about how best to explain it so that DCI Tomlinson would understand. Putting it simply, we manage people's money for them. They are our clients. We advise them where and when they should invest their capital, and then if they agree, we invest their money for them, and then we monitor the performance of the investments, switching them into something else if we believe there is a better return elsewhere.
I see, he said, writing some notes. And how many clients does the firm have?
It's not quite that simple, I said. Even though we are a firm, the advisors are all individuals, and it's they who have the clients. There are 6 qualified and registered IFAs here,